Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. All of our Wise conversations brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets. Newest sponsor, you can find Rob Santoni and some of our pals at in the podcast audio vault, as well as we get ready for baseball season. We think crab cakes. We think downtown. If I look over here and just a little bit around the corner there, you go. Right up Utah Street. If you do not go get them, they're also shipping themselves to Catonsville. I'm about to ship myself all over on a crab cake tour that will stop at State Fair. We're about to put the band back together. Put the coffee back into the pot for Don to go over there and French press and have chicken and waffles and socially distance. We'll be doing that next month. Talk to Evan over there. So we're back to chicken and waffles and our friends and probably something over at El Guapo as well with a proper margarita. Don, I put this up for you behind me. Anybody watching out on our WNSTV channel and YouTube knows that I've been taking this beautiful pictures of downtown from my palatial estate for all these years. I get to use them now. Camden Yards, orange skies, everything's perfect. It's opening day. Don, you want to talk some baseball, so you bring in one of the best investigative reporters in town, right? That's exactly
best investigative reporters, but also a baseball fan. And in the April issue of Baltimore Magazine, we always say, folks, I know you're paying a couple of bucks at the supermarket. When you go to Wise, you're picking it up and paying a couple of dollars.
Hold that up for Ron and for the O. I want Ron, I want you to know he was my hold, push down a little bit. I want to look to see the top. See the little notes there? That's the high school guidance counselor coming out in Moeller. All right. He's got tabs for magazines. He's really weird. People ask me. I'm just saying.
That's because I want to turn to the Birds Are Back in Town.
They are.
Story by our guest senior editor at Baltimore Magazine, Ron Cassie. My goodness, did this article, this is going to be memory lane, because I'm going to take each of you down memory lane, because this article, Ron, did for me, my goodness, my poor mother and Nestor, your mom, I had all these images of baseball and growing up. Tell us about what prompted the story. It's a great story.
Oh, thanks. You know, I am a bit of a Baltimore history buff, and I'm an enormous baseball fan, right? Like, I read books about the 1890 Orioles, and I'm going to disclose something here that most folks won't know, but during the start of the pandemic last year, I started an anonymous Twitter feed called @1970 Orioles, and I live tweeted every game of the season last year, going through the Sun Archive, Sporting News Archive. It got over 4,000 followers by the end of the season. So I'm deeply in the weeds of Orioles history.
But you were not, like, as a child, like, I come honest. My cousin played on the team. It's how I wound up here. I don't remember a life before the Orioles. Santa Claus and the Orioles came at the same time for me.
Well, I don't remember a life before baseball. But, yes, I was born in North Jersey and was a little Mets fan, which I, you know, can't admit to anybody in Baltimore in 19.
What year were you born? That would tell me a lot.
63. So I'm
so you were old enough to remember 69.
Years old when the Mets win.
When Tommy A.G. makes the most crazy
catch. Me and my Gary Martino, the other little Italian kid next door, we throw pop-ups to each other and be Tommy A.G., Cleon Jones, and
Beaver
and Kuzma.
Were you ever Ron Swoboda, though? That would make you a Baltimorean.
No, but I've talked to Ron Swoboda, actually, and I know he's from Sparrows Point, and I know he made the diving catch that robbed a couple RBIs from Brooks Robinson, who was his boyhood idol. I mean, Ron Swoboda will tell you he grew up idolizing Johnny Unitas and Brooks. The fact that he made probably the greatest catch in World Series history is...
And he wasn't a good outfielder. That's how doomed that series was. Listen, that was the year of the... God bless us. The Jets, the Bullets, and Earl the Pearl, and the freaking Mets. I mean, that was not the year to be a Baltimore sports fan.
So this story came, I'll be honest, partly was like, we do an opening day kind of like feature story in the magazine every April. And honestly, after COVID and with, and I'm want to be as optimistic as anybody after winning our first three games in Boston, you know, I didn't have high expectations for the team this year. You know what I mean? I thought like a preview, looking at maybe another 100 loss season.
Well, the 60 strikeouts in Yankee Stadium after that would probably let you know
right.
Exactly. Not good.
Right. And we let up a couple touchdowns in each game. So, I thought something fun, right? Go back to why we love baseball, the very heart of it, the 1954 Orioles coming back after like a half century in Maryland and Baltimore without Major League Baseball, a half century. I mean, the 1890 Orioles of Wee Willie Keeler, right? And John McGraw and Wilbur Robinson. I mean, these guys were the greatest team in baseball. They won three pennants in a row. They won back-to-back World Series. They're the first dynasty. And then they actually moved to New York and become the Highlanders and then morph into the Yankees, right? Irony of ironies. And Baltimore doesn't have a team for 50 years. I mean, the great minor league baseball.
Well, Babe Ruth also, you know, like there's all that, right?
Yeah, there's Ruth who plays for the minor league Orioles. There's Lefty Grove who's from
the place that Babe Ruth was from and playing didn't have a team. That's kind of crazy, right? Like literally, right?
Yeah, we're like the sixth biggest city in the country, at this point. And when you're talking about like the 1950s, you know, an industrial powerhouse, right? Almost a million people. So, it was extraordinary.
Talk about the parade, because Nestor, this is wild.
I've seen pictures of it. Well, and I actually asked Joe Boylan. I was the last person to have Joe Boylan on before he passed away a few weeks ago. And I haven't really talked about it. I don't think I can talk about it because I think I may have been one of the last people he ever talked to. But he talked about being at the game in 54. Like we talked about it because he was of that era and the parade, and I've seen the pictures and all of that. But my father went to the first game, but I never really asked him a whole lot about it. I don't know many of these stories. All 30 years doing radio, Ron. I mean, I'm glad you wrote this story, man.
We're gonna talk parade. Nestor, real quick, it's amazing when we chat on Baltimore Pod. I didn't know you had Joe on for his last
interview. Joe on Wednesday, and he died on Friday.
Smaltimore again.
Get it up onto the website, and we lost him, and I was a little taken. I'm still taken back. A couple weeks later,
you don't know this story, Nestor. This is crazy. When Joe Boylan left to go coach college basketball, he was a social studies teacher at Lansdowne High School.
Mm.
I took Joe Boylan's job. They hired me. The stuff still in the room was Joe Boylan's stuff. So that means that's Smaltimore is Smaltimore.
Well, I'm sorry I didn't put you on with him a couple weeks ago because
I got to know
guy.
Joe well.
Yeah, you're so, a great so, guy.
So, Ron, to tell you how timeless this story is, over the weekend, I'm telling folks we're going to have you on. I say, hey, I'm really excited about this episode. 1954 Orioles. I'm 4 years old at the time. And a friend of mine who's, 8 or 9 years older than I am said, I'll never forget it. I said, forget what? He says, the parade. I said, you were at the parade? He goes, my mother had me at the Remington Books and Gift Store at Charles and Mulberry. Remington Book and Gift Store at Charles and Mulberry. He said it's one of the greatest memories of his life. So tell us about this parade, Ron Cassie.
Well, there's nothing like it in Baltimore City history. There's estimates of like 500,000 people cramming Charles Street. The team arrives, and by the way, Jim Henneman was there.
Okay.
He's in the story. Jim Henneman was there, and I've talked to other people since this story who were there or their parents were there.
All right, so anybody that hears this or sees this that was there, please write to us and let you give us maybe a handful of people says, hey, my Aunt Nellie was there. And she tells me, I'd love to hear that. I'd love to have somebody on who was at the parade.
The digital story, we embedded some newsreel clips that are just unbelievable from the parade. So 500,000 people lying in the streets. The team goes to Detroit. That's where they start in 54. They used to be the St. Louis Browns. They were awful. D'Alessandro and Clarence Miles corral the team out of Bill Veeck's hands and bring him to Baltimore. They can't compete with the Cardinals in St. Louis. The Orioles in 54, split, basically expansion club kind of split two games in Detroit, take a train from Detroit to Camden Yards. That's where they disembark. And they're already in their pressed white home uniforms. They pile into a caravan, like 25 cars, floats, the whole nine yards, marching bands, all of it. and ride from.
Some of these guys have never been to Baltimore, right? They were spring training somewhere. I mean, literally, they come to Baltimore. They're the 24th guy on the worst team, right? Literally, and they get treated like a king, literally, from the minute
like a they king. Arrive. Hey, I mean, if you look, Jimmy Dykes, the manager, the expression on his face is just like of shock. And people were 12 and 15 feet deep on the sidewalks. They were hanging out of the windows and all the stores. Well,
these guys had played for the Browns in front of 2,400 people, right? They stunk, right? My dad would always tell me about Johnny Bernardino from the General Hospital, was their second baseman, I believe.
Yeah.
His baseball card once.
It was a huge, so the huge scene, nothing like this in Baltimore City before or since. I mean, 500,000 people, consider the size of it. It's more than, you know, it's almost a population of Baltimore City today, right? And the
10 times the amount of people that would fit in the stadium.
Right, which was sold out when they got to Memorial Stadium for the actual game. The players had, they're all in convertibles. There's great images of kids riding bikes, of girls and boys running up to the cars to get autographs, shake hands. The players are throwing white plastic baseballs out into the crowd. There's a scramble. It's just a mad scene, the whole thing. I hope people go see the story when it goes on live and just look at the newsreel clips.
The white plastic baseballs, I had heard that story, and I think I've seen them before.
Like 20,000 they threw out. It was great. I'll go back one other thing. What the Orioles, not only was John McGraw's widow there for this and was just blown away by the size of the parade. Of course, he's buried in Baltimore. They brought back two of the players from the 1895 championship Orioles, Boyle Yard Clark and Dirty Jack Boyle, who were like 86 and 88 respectively. And they each hit like more than 300 for those great Oriole clubs. They're brought back there's few old timers left when you haven't had baseball for 54 years. But I just thought that was great. They would bring these old guys back. And there's a picture of them in the Sun archive sitting next to each other on a bench. And it looks like not a day has passed between the two of them. You know, just it was just fantastic. Also still around, Billy Hunter, who was the starting shortstop in 1954. And I see Nestor shaking his head, nodding his head. Billy Hunter and Don knows was the Orioles' third base coach for all the glory years.
He gets 14 years. You know what I didn't know, Ron? I would have missed 14 years. You pointed out he was the third base coach.
Oh, I mean, he was sort of Weaver's sidekick until he went to Texas, and they chased him out of there pretty quick. And I mean, Billy had a hell of a career at Towson. I mean, I would see Billy all the time at Towson events and stuff in the 80s, 90s, you know, when he came back. I mean, Billy Hunter's a fixture in this town, literally, right? You know, after showing up for this parade, right? Literally.
Well, and Ron, you tell the story, right, about how he uses his World Series money. That's a cool story.
Yeah, so he gets traded. I think you guys probably know the story. Paul Richards becomes GM by the end of the season. I mean, the Orioles, who they beat on opening day is, we could talk about the game itself, they beat the Chicago White Sox, who win 90-some games. But the Orioles then steal Paul Richards, the manager, before the season's even over and give him the managing job for the next season and the GM job. And he pulled it off, this like 18 player, three team trade, and Billy Hunter, Bullet Bob Turley, Don Larson all get traded from the Orioles to the Yankees. A couple of
things
guys.
Worked out for Larson, from what I understand.
It worked out for Bob Turley.
That was a good day for him, I think. So
fair enough. And it worked out for Bob Turley, who won a Cy Young. It was not a good trade for the Orioles. I mean,
no.
Suffice to say. But it was good for Billy Hunter as well. He got World Series money, as Dom points out, the following year, because guys like Mickey Mantle were there. And he buys it, puts a down payment on a house in Conkeysville, where he still lives to this day.
That's remarkable.
There's never a lot. The jobs of the coaching. I mean, he had to manage a lot of games. When you're second in command to Earl Weaver, you're actually going to manage a lot of games, right? Colorful guy himself. So he was there for the parade, there for the game. And, you know, he said, you know, he's with the Orioles, went to multiple World Series, won a bunch of rings with the Yankees, unbelievable career. And with 100 lost teams, he said, you know, he told me there's not a lot that stands out from that season after everything in his career afterward. But the parade stands out. That's the indelible thing from that day. He said, He recalled it like it happened yesterday, Nestor. He was recalling that people were everywhere. They're hanging out the windows all the way through downtown. He's in a car with Vernon Stevens and Chico Garcia throwing balls to the crowd. And he said it was like they had won the war or the World Series at least, and they hadn't even played a game yet in Baltimore. And he said the guys couldn't believe it. He said they were looking at each other in the backseat of the car. Like,
well, Ron, I'll tell you, and I've told this story a bunch over the last year. I rode in the Ravens parade in 01 by accident. I didn't want to do it. I was sick. Billick made me do it. And they had these video cameras, and Mike Flynn, David Modell had gifted them. By the way, this is a little sports story for you. He did a gift bag, David Modell, and was in the room for all the players. The next year, Ozzie got charged against the cap for all the money.
Oh, wow.
Oh, true story. Yeah. It was a cap expenditure. Well, because it was all out that these guys had all cameras, right? So Flynn had me hold the camera. I shot the parade, and I didn't want to ride in. I don't like parades. Moeller will tell you, even the Catonsville parade. I love you, but I'm not a parade guy. And the hair on the back of my neck would stand up telling you about it. I shot the video. Flynn lost the video for 19 years. Last May, it showed up in my mailbox. It was in a format that I had to get Greg Landry over at Blue Rock to figure out, some high eight weird thing that nobody would have. And we debuted it last summer, and it's an hour and 5 minutes. And putting that thing on again and I mean, you say, what was it, parade, and Tom Brady throws a big trophy and all. But when you're in it, it's surreal. I mean, it's unlike any – you could say, well, I was at the game when a guy hit a home run or scored a touchdown or any of those emotions, or I saw Mick Jagger once, or I saw the Pope, or whatever that thing you would say that you would remember. Parades of this kind, for Billy Hunter 70 years later to be talking about it, that doesn't shock me, because for the rest of my life, I would say I've done a lot of things in my life. Man, those parades are – uniquely, when you're in them, you will remember them the rest of your life. And I didn't even know that before, and I wouldn't even believe it if you told me until you experience it. So when I hear that from those players, that I don't think, like a war being over or something like that, that's kind of what it reminds me of.
We are with
New York ticker tape parade, and that's it was like Charles Street was kind of like that canyon you see.
I didn't even know it was on Charles Street. So now I have a vision, because that's where all the shopping was, right? I mean, it's where
this friend of mine said he was at Remington Books and Gifts, and a couple other people that were older and said, oh, I love that store. That was a great store. And it was at the corner of Charles and Mulberry. And they all remembered the store, and his mom would take him shopping to Remington Books and Gifts. And
so, Ron, riddle me this. It started at Camden Yard, started here, and it went north on Charles, and then went to 33rd Street? Is that? And they were in their uniforms and literally got out and started taking fungos? Is that?
I don't think that they got started. They went out and started taking fungos right away. But yeah, basically, Billy Hunter couldn't remember how long it took. You know, it was just time stopped. You know, and Jim Henneman said the same thing. And I talked to two other people since who were there, and it's such an indelible memory. I'm blown away that people don't remember it that well anymore. It's a little bit of a lost history kind of moment. I mean, I remember the 83 parade, and there's some great images of like Eddie Murray and people running up to the cars. But
see, I didn't attend that. I went to every game. You know, I was a fanatic. Wow. I felt no. I Moeller made me come to school. Moeller wouldn't. I mean, Moeller was my guy. If I had, you know, signed Nestor's mom, he attended the parade. That was an unexcused absence. Miss Monday would not have liked that. But literally, I was 15. I could have gone. I just didn't. And I went to. I love the Orioles. I just didn't feel like I needed to go to the parade. You know.
Well, I think the most exciting moment I ever had in Orioles history was actually I was at the Delmon Young game when he hit the double.
Oh yeah.
And I was in the upper deck behind home plate with a perfect sight line of the left field line. And when he hit it, you weren't sure. I knew it was going to be fair. You didn't know if it was going to get past the left fielder or not. And all of a sudden I see people in the bleachers on the other side, right? Like in left field bleachers, leaning over and pounding the wall. And then other ones are raising their hands. And I realized from their reaction, it was going to get past the left fielder. And three runs might score. And, you know, it was bedlam. It was delirium. But like
everyone describes that moment in the modern, there's no number two other than Ripken. You know, I mean, not that that's any small thing, but
there was nothing like the pure adrenaline, the Delman moment. You know, I was at the Ripken thing, and but still.
If you're an Oriole fan, and I'm not being pissy because it's opening, and I have my delusions on, but this place has been here 29 years. There haven't been a whole lot of moments where you really felt like they could win the World Series. You know, you had the 96, and 96 was a little bit of an – we weren't all that great. 97, we thought we were going to win and didn't. Every minute you thought you were going to win. That Delman Young moment, because that season was kind of out of nowhere. You know, all those seasons that when Buck was here, they were never like the preseason, like they were going to win 100 games. They were never perceived that way. That moment was we can win the World Series, and we haven't had a lot of that.
No, well, remember now, in defense of him, Ron, right? Tell Nestor, the Orioles under Buck for 3 years won the most games in the American League.
Yeah.
They won the most games in the American League. I mean, you said they couldn't win a World Series.
But that was the moment where you felt like we're going to win the World Series. You know, like that was a different kind of feeling. If you're, and everyone describes it that way. So it's not. I think it's universal, the Delman Young moment.
Right. Hey, Ron.
Like the Tito Landrum moment.
Back up before we do Paul Richards and the Oriole Way. I'm intrigued because you really capture the role, and I've known people who knew him well, know the family well, but the role that Mayor Tommy D'Alessandro Jr. played and working with Clarence Miles, getting the team here – was not easy. It was not an easy task. Talk a little bit about that, because he's revered for that.
Well, most people know the Moog story because it's modern. I don't really know this story. I can't wait to hear it.
So the condensed version is Bill Veeck, colorful character, owns the St. Louis Browns, and the Cardinals are in the same town. The Cardinals actually play at Sportsman Park, which is owned by the Browns. And the Cardinals are, of course, the Gas House Gang, legendary team. Browns, not so much. The Browns own the stadium, and the Cardinals owner essentially looks like he's on his way to jail because of tax evasion. And Veeck thinks he can basically win the city. One of them is going to have to leave. There's not enough. St. Louis is not big enough for two teams, right? Like Boston with the Braves. Ultimately, Anheuser-Busch puts in a bid for the Cardinals, and Veeck realizes that's it. I've lost. So he starts looking for a place to go. First, he looks for Milwaukee. Everybody's moving west with the population trends. The AL owners don't want him there. They want him out of baseball. They let Boston Braves move to become the Milwaukee Braves. Veeck, D'Alessandro, Clarence Miles, visionaries, they see what's happening in St. Louis. They've been desperate to find a team. They reach out to Veeck and start negotiating to bring the team here. The initial deal says Bill Veeck will still be the owner, own 80% of the franchise. AL owners don't approve that. They want Veeck out completely. And initially, D'Alessandro and Miles are really hurt by, like, really like, what are we going to do? But then they realize that the owners just want Veeck out. They don't mind this team coming to Baltimore. So Clarence Miles and D'Alessandro have to go around and hustle up 80% more of the buying share to get the team. And of course, Gerald Hofberger owns Natty Bo. He steps up to the plate with the money. And, you know, it's a marriage made in heaven, the Orioles and Natty Bo, right? I mean, that's how it's done. They need more money to get the team. And
the land of pleasant living, man.
And this time, you know, it's not just Anheuser-Busch owning the Cardinals. The Yankees are owned by a big brewer. I mean, baseball and beer, right? It doesn't get any more symbiotic in America.
Augie Bush wasn't nearly as nice a man as Hofberger, apparently, right? Like, I mean, Hofberger held it forever. And, you know, every time I've talked to Larry Lucchino or any of those people, you know, of that era, you know, Charlie Steinberg, people that were around it, at that point, it just, you know, he held it a long time. And sold some beer, but it was not a financially, for all it was, it didn't make a whole lot of money for a long, long time.
No. And he's, I think, well-respected by all the players who his general managers were pretty tight-fisted, right? Because there was no free agency. Players did not make a lot of money in those days. But
not even Brooks.
Hofberger provides a stability, and the money provides stability. And that's when they're able to get Paul Richards, who kind of starts the Orioles way, and the front office, you know, of Cashin and Jim Russo and an early farm director, Jim McLaughlin. I mean, these are all the guys that are in place. This is one of the key parts of the story that, you know, real baseball fans will appreciate. The team on the field is going to turn over completely, but the people in the front office, the pieces are in place for that great Orioles run from 1960 to 1983-84. That's what sets the franchise up for the greatest success of any professional franchise ever, that 2.5-decade run that the Orioles have.
Well, Ron, you make a point in the article, and I want to go back to Mayor D'Alessandro in a minute, but you made a point in the article that I had never heard before, was that Richards and that scouting group came up with this idea of two eyes on every scout, which you said was really the precursor to analytics. That was interesting.
Yeah, these guys were kind of Moneyball guys before Moneyball. They holistically graded players. They rated them numerically, which wasn't done. You know, it was all just to give you a sense, right? Like, also the first offseason the Orioles ever had. So the first offseason after 54, Paul Richards gets a letter from an old buddy in Arkansas about a schoolboy player named Brooks Robinson, right? Maybe you want to take a look at this kid. So the cornerstone of the franchise is even on its way here in 1954. But yes, you know, bird dog and scouting, there's no video of players, there's no email, there's none of that. It's all word of mouth kind of thing. And they want to get two eyes on everybody. And that included the Jim Palmers who'd come along, that included the Boog Pals. Hey, do we need two eyeballs on Davey Johnson, you know, great ball player? They did. They wanted two eyeballs on everybody. And
even that good-looking shortstop they traded for in 64 from the south side of Chicago, who, when you mentioned Bill Veeck being a legendary prick, when Frank Robinson died a couple years ago, I went looking for like a little of my own history. And I found some Aparicio stories from that period of time about why he wound up here, why I wound up here, you know, inevitably.
Yeah.
And it really led to him being mistreated by Bill Veeck. And that when he got here, same with Frank. I mean, Frank was clearly in Cincinnati, you know, treated like people were treated in Cincinnati when they were dark skinned in 1959. Right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, part of Hofberger's charm was taking, you know, my cousin who no speaky too good, you know, wanted to live somewhere safe and be appreciated. I mean, he was little Louis signing autographs and not being able to pay his bills because he was from the island and didn't have representation. I mean, all of that. And Hofberger, the reason they won in 66 was because this became a place players wanted to play when Augie Bush threw them out. They would send Steve Carlton to Philadelphia, right? Like if you've read Lords of the Realm, you know all this stuff. But this became a safe place for a black man who was a Hall of Famer and a short, little, fast Venezuelan who was a Hall of Famer to come from other places and win a championship with the other guys they brought.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget, you know, guys like Don Buford and Mike Cuellar also became cornerstones of the franchise. And this is a time where it's really still more in the National League where black players and Latino players are having success. I mean, the reason that the National League wins all those all-star games in the 70s, starting in the late 60s and 70s, is because they have all the great black Latino and black ball players.
You got Clemente, Mays, Aaron, McCovey, they're coming in with those guys, yeah.
1971 Pirates. First team to start, entire team of black and Latino players, and they win the World Series that year. I mean, most of our consternation. But yeah, so Baltimore is a sense of that kind of welcoming place, and that relationship between Brooks, of course, and Frank, you know, lifelong friends. And I did speak to Brooks, you know, for this story as well, which was great. And you know, he knew the minor leagues. He's in Vancouver. He had his ups and downs, like all young ball players.
You know, Brooks stunk when he came up, right? Wasn't he legendarily one for something awful?
There's a great story about Brooks. He goes like 2 for 3 in his first game. And he calls his parents in Arkansas. And it's like, because he's playing in New York. And he's like 18 at the time. He gets a late season call. He goes, this is easy. I don't know why I haven't been up here all year. And then he goes 0 for 23. Exactly. He had a ways to go, but you know, there's interesting. I did this story too. There's an early Sun story from like 1957 or something from the Winter Leagues. He's in like Columbia, and the Sun headlines in the winter is O's might be okay at third base.
yeah, that worked. That kind of worked out.
Worked out. So there was a report that this guy might be a pretty good ball player.
But probably the nicest human being ever put on the planet. Yeah. So, hey, Ron, there was a tidbit in your article, and I thought, well, dang, go on. That's a sad story. After all the work Mayor D'Alessandro had done. I think you even talked about they presented him with a baseball bat. Yeah. He said, I could have used it when I was negotiating to bring the team here. But then you said he got sick and was in the hospital and couldn't go to the parade?
Couldn't be there for opening day. Actually, this goes to the stress I think Nestor brings us up. Nestor probably know, you know, the works behind the scenes that go into luring a franchise is fraught. That's right. All the way around. Clarence Miles, after they get the team, goes into the hospital for a 2-week stay for exhaustion. He's the lawyer who's doing the deal.
Okay.
He's in the fundraising. And then D'Alessandro also goes into the hospital for an extended stay for what was called exhaustion at the time. And he's not there on opening day to throw out the game ball. Vice President Richard Nixon, by all indications, through a strike throughout the first pitch in his place. So,
hey, by the way, little Nancy Pelosi would have remembrances of this, right?
Well, that would be her grandmother.
Right? I mean, she might have been at the parade, maybe, right? We should talk to Uncle Ted about that, too.
I would assume a young girl like Nancy Pelosi was at the time in Baltimore, her dad being mayor, would have been there. Yeah, you would think.
Well, I'm just thinking, you said the mayor wasn't there because he was sick. I'm thinking, you know.
And the mayor's wife, Nestor, was named Nancy. It's her namesake. So I think it's pretty good bet that Nancy was at the
next
parade.
Time she's on the show, we're asking her about
this. Nestor, here's Ron, you've got to talk about. We were going to do other stuff. We're going to do this. We'll have you back to talk about the other stuff. This is too much fun. But I love baseball. My mother was a baseball fanatic.
Yeah.
I can almost tear up like Nestor does something with her. You know, she was single mom, but made sure she was always taking her boys out to 33rd Street. We'd get the popcorn in the megaphone thing and the ice cream in the Oriole hat, the whole shebang.
Yeah.
But I thought I knew a lot of Oriole history. You have some characters on that 54 team. You talk about a guy named Eddie Watkins. Now, there's an Oriole I'd never heard of who ends up being the inspiration for Robert Redford in The Natural. I go, now, come on now, Ron Cassie.
It's hard to believe what you find. I think his name might have been pronounced Eddie Wakis. He was
Wakis, is that Eddie Wakis?
He was the Orioles' 34-year-old first baseman. I mean, if you're on essentially an expansion club, right? You're either like a has-been or never was, right? Those are the kind of...
Did they make an SK card for him, and was it greasy? I just need to know.
I don't know. I should
remember the SK cards? They were big collectors, 54, 55.
I really find the print edition of the magazine as well. The design by our team and the artifacts, the baseball cards that we have images of, photographs of, the Oriole memorabilia, the artifacts are just fantastic. Eddie Wakis had been shot years before as a ball player in a Chicago hotel by a female stalker. And that incident is said to have inspired Bernard Melmoth's classic, The Natural. I mean, he was the young guy up and coming, was shot by a female stalker, which shortly thereafter launches Melmoth into this, you know, great, great novel, a really dark novel, ultimately, if anybody actually goes back and read it.
Right.
It does not end like the movie does.
Well, who knew? And then you've got Vic Wertz, who's playing for the Orioles, who gets traded to Cleveland. And for people not as old as me, tell them how that turned out and why that's very significant in baseball history, Ron.
Vic Wertz, Orioles, big slugger from York, Pennsylvania, gets traded to Cleveland during the World Series. Cleveland is an unbelievable team in 1954, right? Great starting pitching. He hits the blast in the World Series at the Polo Grounds that Willie Mays catches over the basket catch over his head. That's the greatest catch or most famous catch, at least, in baseball history. So that's what happens to Vic Wertz, but he started that year in Baltimore Memorial Stadium. There's a lot of characters. I mean,
I pulled this up for you guys watching out here, man. I found the 54 Eddie Wakis hand cut. You know, these are the old, and I have no idea what these cards are worth. But I mean, I'm doing a story next week. Mark Miller is a lifetime friend of mine who's a Blondell Miller Schuler. I was sitting in his office, socially distanced, eating some Pizza John's, and we started talking baseball cards and the renaissance of baseball cards and all that. So I had a little fun with that because the stuff of that era. That's how I knew these guys' names, Ron, right? I mean, that's how I knew baseball players that played on the Mets in the late 60s. Is I, my dad, my family, we had baseball cards.
Well, I had all the Orioles cards. I knew the whole roster as a kid, even when I was in New Jersey.
You flipped them, right?
You don't see in the car, but Eddie Wakis has a scar from a bullet wound somewhere on his body in that car.
Who knew? Robert Redford. And then you've got Clint Courtney getting in fights every other week with Billy Martin, who's playing second base for
Clint Courtney, we have a picture in the magazine, hits the first home run of Memorial Stadium. And there's very few. It's 457 to the alleys and center
field.
That's
a cavern, dude.
Nobody hits like a, I don't think they hit 10 that year for the Orioles, but they hit two on opening day. That's how magical it is. And Clint Courtney, who looks like Harry Truman. I mean, he's short, stocky. He's got the spectacles on, but his nickname is Scrap Iron. He was famous for his on the field brawls with a couple with Billy Martin, not surprisingly. But yeah, he hits one out. And Don Larson is the starting pitcher on the first opening day. No, I'm sorry. Don Larson is the starting pitcher. He goes 3-21 for the Orioles that year.
I think Turley started opening game, right?
Turley started, right. Pitched a great game, went the distance, allowed one run. So you get Clint Courtney hits one out. Vern Stevens hits one out. Bullet Bob Turley goes the distance. The Orioles went 3-1. And remarkably, after splitting in Detroit, they're in first place when they go home that night. And all the fans from that parade, 500,000 people, 50,000 at Memorial Stadium. The O's are in first place. I mean, they won't be in first place again, even for a day, for like four or five more years. And then, of course, by 1960, they're the baby birds, and they make a great run at the Yankees that year. And the Orioles are that we come to love are on their way at that point.
Well, Don still loves them, and it's a great story. You can go check it out at Baltimore Magazine. Ron Cassie is joining us here, talking some memories, I guess, more than anything. I don't know there'll be any parades here this year. Maybe get a parade for keeping the team here, when all this is over with. But, Don, for what the parade represented for a lifetime for you, right, that this team comes when you're a little boy, it comes before I'm heard of, and my cousin plays a role in the history, and I wind up talking on radio for 30 years about it. I guess it really does speak to the significance of baseball in this community, right? That I love baseball. I'm like, I built my whole life around baseball. The fact that I don't love it anymore is shame on them, not shame on me. Like, that's how I feel about it currently. And there's a long way to go to get this thing to where it needs to be and coming out of COVID. But part of it is guys like you, and you're going to take your kids back, they need to have a good experience when they come back. And that's for the future. That's where we need to be. And I think that coming out of COVID, I hope the Orioles are ready to blossom again. I really do. It would be good for our community. It always has been.
Well, it would be. And I, again, I'm sure I think if I were even at four, I don't know what I remember from four, but I think had I been at the parade, I would remember it. I doubt that I was at the parade, but I certainly have incredible.
Apparently you're the only one.
I have incredible Oriole memory. I mean, when Ron wrote about me, you touch on this, Ron, you broke my heart again. You already started with 69, and then you wrote about the I was 10 years old in 1960. I'm an old guy, so I remember the baby birds, and you listed them. Chuck Estrada, Milt Pappas, related to the Pappases with Crab Cakes Nestor, Steve Barber and Fat Jack Fisher. And I think it was actually a fifth pitcher line named Jerry Walker as well on that team. I remember that September series. We had just beaten the Yankees the week before, and everyone was convinced that we were going to win the pennant. And that weekend in New York did not go well, right?
No, it didn't. And, this is the Yankees of Mantle and Maris, an interesting – Brooks mentioned that, all of his accomplishments, he said, I finished third in the MVP race that year. I mean, of course, Brooks isn't bragging. It's just one, a special time in his life that he's recalling as a young ball player, unexpected. You baby birds, come out of nowhere. Paul Richards, these young guys. And it's, one thing you do, what happens when when you look into the baseball, there's so many great ball players, so many great stories. And there's so many guys, whose careers are cut short, especially pitchers because of like arm injuries and things like that. Or Ronnie Hansen with a back injury, ended up going to, he traded places with Louis Aparicio, right? But that's also, there's a lot, you know, it's the human side of the game that these players are not, most of them have off-season, they all have off-season jobs back then. You know, I mean, even Boog Powell and those guys did. And it's, and there's such a part of the fabric of the community. You know, most of them live in row houses. You mentioned still Pappas's crab cakes. Billy Hunter's still here. Ron Hansen's still here. Brooks Robinson's still here. Jim Palmer, listening to him on the ball games, you know, is great. So, yeah, it's all knitted together, you know, the, and it's, you know, it's funny too. I think Nestor, you know, you said you're not a baseball fan anymore. I still am. You know, I get,
no, it's not that I'm not a baseball fan anymore. I just don't live my life around it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, right.
I don't find it compelling. I don't find the game interesting. I don't find the analytics interesting. I don't find the work these people do behind me to be very compelling in the community, to be really honest with you.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah, no.
I'm a guy they should want at the games. I'm a guy they should want, not my money, they should want my heart because they've had it for 50 years. That's all.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying.
I'm pissed off. I have every reason to be pissed off. I mean, this isn't my quote. This is what the owner said about me. You know, and 15 years later, I haven't had a media pass. So I'm just saying, fine. Don't win me over. Win everybody. You know, have a plan to make this as vibrant as it should be and as important as it's been to all of us all these years. That's not me being a prick. That's me challenging them to do better, which is all I've ever done, literally.
My daughter, I took, you know, her first game, she was 6 months old at Memorial Stadium. I wanted to make sure that she got there. You know what I mean? She was 6 months old. We went to a game. We went to games forever and in the 90s when they were good every year. And then when you lose, what, 14 or 15 straight losing seasons. There's no investment in the community. We stopped going along the way. You know what I mean?
See, but I had to cover it. And when Ron calls from Fells Point or Don calls from Catonsville or Towson and says, what's wrong with the Orioles? Tell me what's really the story with the Orioles. And I, for 4 hours a day, I'd have to say, well, the owner's kind of a jerk and he kind of mistreats everyone, and that's why Davey's not here, and that's why Cal's like never going to work there. And 20 years later, it has been devastating. It's tough for me to talk about it without getting a little bit chippy because all of that promise of 54 and Brooks and all seeing Palmer on television last night, seeing Palmer freeze his ass off on opening day, sitting out there 32 degrees, thinking you can't move him inside. They didn't show spring training game. I mean, I go through the list of all of this. Why I don't do sports radio all day because.
Yeah,
it's not good, and it needs to be better.
John Miller's not here.
Yeah, the John Miller story is.
I spent 10 years trying to explain that. John Miller was in my studio. I sat and watched him sob on my air, playing the quotes of Peter Angelo's blaming his wife.
Just let go. You know, Gary Thorne was a great team with Jim Palmer, one of the best in baseball.
Ron, I have a.
Well, you're a Mets fan. You're going to say that, you know.
Well, I'll tell you one funny thing. When I was a kid, my cousin Nancy from New Jersey met her future husband working at the Ocean City Boardwalk in Maryland. And every holiday, my cousin-in-law, he was from Baltimore and the biggest Baltimore fan ever. And we're in New Jersey and he's always going on about it all the time. The Orioles and the Colts, nonstop. So I knew all these stories from Thanksgiving, from Christmas, from July 4th. You know, from the time I could walk, essentially.
My point is a lot of places don't have that kind of story for Don Mueller on the west side, Nestor on the east side, two different generations, what it means to them, how it converged, you know, and you go on this ride together. That's what makes sports beautiful. That's why I've spent my life around it. Well, and I want that to continue, you know, and I don't feel like it's in that direction without a lipstick.
And that's where... Go ahead, Ryan.
Well, I was going to say, to connect to the 54, you know, part of that 500,000 people in the sold-out crowd is there was pent-up demand and frustration that we didn't have a team for so long. And it's the same, I think, when you go through these extended losing streaks. And then suddenly, Bucks here and you're winning, right? Or, you know, I think we're in that situation again where we win a couple of the first three games and suddenly, you know, people are interested in baseball again. And you just get a hint of what the city could be like again, you know?
And I think it will be, Ron. That's where Nestor and I probably part ways or have lively discussions.
I don't think it's going to be done with these creeps. No, I think it's going to take Yeah, someone not named John Ange. I mean, I just, I've watched this too long. Well, then we disagree. You have no track record to tell me that John Angelos is going to fix this.
I totally, where I disagree with that, I'm all in.
Well, I mean, you buy tickets and
you didn't let me finish. You're not letting me talk.
And I'm banned. So it's different. It's just different.
You're just yelling. You're not letting me talk. I understand. You don't like the Angelos family. I get that. I happen to
think. I don't like what they've done to my community.
Okay, that's let me know when you're done, and I'm going to – but I happen to think that Mike Elias and Sid Minnell and these guys are doing – you mentioned the Oriole way, Ron, and yeah. You can chime in. I believe we are back to that. We're not rushing prospects. We're building up the arms in the farm system.
I always want to talk about the business of how they run, not the team.
Let me finish.
I agree with everything you're saying.
Let me finish. I will be the first to apologize – if this doesn't come to fruition. I believe John Angelos, when he says the franchise will be here, I believe John Angelos is in this for the long haul, and I'm willing to look forward because I think baseball is an important part of our
community. John Angelos is in this for the long haul, I'm willing to bet anything, you will not have a parade here down Charles Street on the baseball side. Yeah.
And you and you and I disagree on
fair enough.
Well, I think we're going to keep an eye on the potential sale, like we are the Baltimore Sun at the moment. But I just want to make one thing, you know, before we wrap up. What's special about baseball, right? It's not
that we care so much.
Why such an important part of this of city life? And you know, my grandfather saved his nickels to go see he was a bowling pin setter. To see Babe Ruth play Yankee Stadium with his cousin Frankie. They're both named Frankie. My dad grew up a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, and one of his favorite ball players was Roy Campanella, who starred first for the Baltimore Elite Giants. You know, and then I grew up because the Mets were new when I was born. I grew up a Mets fan. I come to Baltimore. I'm taking my daughters to a game when she's 6 months old. And baseball is played every day. You know, it's 162 games. That's what's different. There's a box score every day. There's a game every day. You can walk to the ballpark and sit out in the sunshine, and there's no clock. It's not, the pace isn't
right.
Hurt.
Takes 27 outs.
You know, guys are wearing helmets, and I love football, I love basketball, but it's not a play at 100 miles an hour. It's a pace you can talk, you can have a beer, have a hot dog, and that's why it's such a fabric of our you know, country. It lasts from spring to fall. You know, it's something that's with us every day, and when the team is just competitive, right, Nestor? Always say just if you're 500 and you're competitive, it makes you just wanting to go after work or on a sunny Sunday, you know. I think that's why.
Ron, have you been? You mentioned
the are not there now.
Yeah, you mentioned the Elite Giants. Have you been the baseball buff that you are? I can't remember if I've asked you this before. Have you visited the Hubert Simmons Negro Baseball Museum in Owings Mills? Spectacular.
Yeah, I have, and I would love for the city. I think. There's statues of the Orioles at Camden Yards. I think we need a statue of Judd Wilson, of Leon Day, of Roy Campanella, of those guys down there too that won championships for the Elite Giants, for the Chicago Black Sox. That's a history. That's Baltimore baseball history that needs to be celebrated. Those guys are all in the Hall of Fame too, by the way.
Yeah, there's no finer man than Mr. Banks who runs that thing and put so much time. Yeah. Just a
and
wonderful.
You know, my partner Alan McCallum is also
Alan McCallum's involved. Hey, sure. One quick before you go, you've written a lot about Palmer too. One of the things we agree on is Jim Palmer, one of Nestor's favorite Orioles ever. What's your favorite, other than pancakes? What's your favorite Jim Palmer story?
Well, when Jim spent on his 50th anniversary of his first opening day in Baltimore, I spent the day with Jim. We talked on the phone a bunch of times. So I was in the broadcast booth with him all day with Bordick as he was kibitzing and everything. He went out throughout the first pitch that day. And so just to follow him around, to be in the booth was great. And, you know, he was chatting up Zach Britton then in the Orioles locker room and giving him some advice about keeping his arm healthy. And it kind of scared me for a moment because I was beginning to get worried there's something actually wrong with Britton. But Palmer is walking out and he's talking to Mark Viviano beforehand saying, you know, look, when you throw out the first pitch, you have to be on the grass. Don't get on the mound or the rubber. That's when these guys like 50 Cent make a mistake. Go to the grass, make it a short throw. Don't be a big shot and go stay on the rubber. And that's what Palmer says, his advice to Viviano. And so when Palmer goes out, what does he do? He
Right to the rubber.
He goes right to the rubber. And he whistles in a strike low and outside. And he gets to the dugout and Buck chides him a little bit. You know, he says, I think they framed that one for you a little bit. So just, they may have been outside with the catcher. But you know, that was Jim Palmer. And I like Jim Palmer so much because he gives of himself so much to Orioles fans. You know, he's been here all along. He's very accessible. He gives the fans. He knows this history, by the way. He was signed like in 64, 65. He knows when – he remembers when Earl and Kyle Sr. were coaching the minor leagues.
Jim Palmer remembers everything.
Well, the story he told the other night, I'm sure you guys heard it because you were watching. When he talked about Weaver not liking the pitch selection and saying Weaver would be screaming at him, throw the curve next time. And he said, of course, I never listened. But when I came in, I said to Earl, did it ever dawn on you that the hitter, if you think I can hear it, do you think the hitter can hear you as well? You know, throw the curve, Jim. And Palmer said, what's wrong with it?
I appreciate about doing the Jim Palmer story and spending some time with him and stuff was it didn't come across, I don't think, when he was an icon and the jockey underwear model and all that stuff. And
doing the World Series on ABC. I mean, you know, literally, he was a broadcaster, a real broadcaster.
Right. Super handsome and everything. He cares deeply about his teammates and about the game. You know, when he announced his retirement, he couldn't even get through it. He started tearing up and had to leave the press conference. And I think when you talk about his memory, the way he talks about his team, underneath that persona, when he was a superstar in the 70s, and he really cares about his teammates, really cares about the Orioles, really cares about baseball. And I think
I honestly wonder why he still does it. You know what I mean? It's clear that this is oxygen and a contribution from him that he feels needed, you know, in some way. And he listened to the broadcast, you know.
Well, Nestor, how about the fact you're a broadcaster and Ryan, you know, you're right. You have to do research. How about the fact you, that's a great point you just made, Nestor, because what I'm blown away by is he could mail it in. He doesn't. He still prepares. He still researches. The guy is mid seventies and he still prepares.
How many Cy Youngs did he win? Three.
But he's also a bit of, you know, Palmer's never done the show. I love Jim Palmer. I've never had a public conversation with Jim Palmer. So all 30 years, you know, Jim, if you're out there, I'd love to have you on the show and have a conversation. If not, that's cool too. You're still hanging at WNST eating pancakes and I'll love you forever. And you're the greatest Oriole ever. But the thing about him is all due respect to the beer guy. I mean, Jim's one of the world's most interesting men, right? And that's why I've always wanted him on. And that's why I've always given him a pass. Like if he doesn't like me, I like him anyway. You know what I mean? And whenever I've been around him, I mean, I remember one night sitting at the Harbor Castle Westin in Toronto when I was on the beat 93, 4, 5, 6, going with the team, staying in the hotel. Jim Palmer sat in a hotel all night for 5 hours and just talked baseball with me at a bar. I think he made him pick the tab up. You know what I mean? But the storytelling and all the things Jim Palmer could be doing with his life, right?
Yeah.
Other than sitting at a freezing his ass off with Scott Garceau and calling games for whatever couple grand they're giving him, you know, every night. I really do feel like there's a part of him that's almost saintly in that way because everyone else, especially with Baltimore, it was easy to say, don't want to be there anymore. I could do this, do that, whatever. Jim's always been here. I mean, I tip my cap to Jim. I love Jim Palmer.
Well, and Ron mentions the Cy Youngs. I said to someone the other day, because you talk baseball when baseball season begins. Right? I said to someone the other day, I haven't looked this up, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. I should have looked it up before you came on. I think there was one year where he had 25 complete games. I think he had 20.
He's offended by these kids pitching 70 pitches in 4 innings, and he's offended by it. It's obvious. He's always been offended by it.
Yeah, I think you know Weaver. The story he told me one time was Weaver came out in like a ninth inning. You know, and he's laboring. Palmer's laboring, got like a one run lead, guy or two on base. And we return, tell Palmer to turn around and look at the bullpen. You see anybody better out there than you?
Well, you know, that makes it okay, we could do this. So, we could do this for hours.
And you know, right? Jim probably could have turned to Earl, looked down at Earl and said, is there ever anybody out there?
You know, the other one, Ron, God, we could do that. I don't know if Palmer told you this one. The other one I love is where he was getting squeezed by the umpire and Weaver comes to the mound and he waits for the umpire to get to the mound. And he turns to the umpire. I'll clean it up. Even though it's a podcast, I'll clean it up. And he goes, you know who the F this is? This is F and Jim Palmer. So let's just have a chat here for a minute. Why don't you just tell us where you'd like him to throw it for it to be a strike.
And he'll throw it there.
He'll throw it there. Then we won't have any more problems for the rest of the game. You just tell him where you'd like it to be, and he'll throw it there. Let's stop this silliness.
It's amazing. His extraordinary, like I think, intelligence, observation skills, his dedication, his diligence, the amount of how hard he works, his work ethic, his caring, his passion for the game.
And he could beat you playing tennis left-handed apparently too.
That's what I understand. Like, though, from the guy who won 286 games to the announcer you see now in his 70s, still on the Major League app every night, still knowing every up-and-coming ball player in the league, what they did in the minors, still having conversations with guys on ball clubs from out of town before the game starts, sitting on the bench, talking to the Orioles' young pitchers. That's what's remarkable about him to me, too, his saintly quality. You know, he brings the same level of intensity, you know, and diligence and hard work to the booth every night.
You know, one thing I love about him that gets, well, I don't talk about him much and I'm probably never, it's kind of like, I don't even want him on any, I mean, like literally, I'd be a little embarrassed of what to say to him at this point, but for him to be such a competitive dude, you know what I mean? Like in that competitive way, he has pissed off a lot of these kids, right? Like I saw it back when I had a media credential. There would be a whole faction of the guys who'd be like, don't let that old guy in here telling me what to do. You know what I mean?
Well, he was,
like,
he was so. Been,
yeah. But that's been going on for 25 years. That's not one guy. That's half the guys that ever came through here who couldn't wear his jockeys, right? But he has a way about him that there's an arrogant, you know, whatever that would be, that self-assuredness, self-confidence, wherever you want to draw that line, that some knock-kneed 25-year-old, 6'7", you know, Ben McDonald took to him because Ben was smart, right? But there were a lot of guys here that Jim offended, and with his greatness, you know, and I've always found, like, if you don't want to listen to Jim Palmer, you're probably not going to be very good.
Right. Well, that was like the other day, guys, went but right
Tillman,
in Boston.
He had a good relationship.
Who's that?
Tillman.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, he liked, because he thought he had a lot of, you know, a lot of potential, a lot of grit, and he liked the way he hung in there. But the other day in Boston, I think, Nestor, what you talk about was on full display, and it wasn't related to the Orioles. It was related to the Red Sox. They had put on one of those 2021 shifts where they brought the shortstop over to the other side of second base, and it was a guy on first base, and the Oriole hitter just hit it right to where the shortstop would be. And Palmer said, you got to explain to me how you're not in double play position there. It's just, you know, he went on and on about how stupid. And he said, and then he knows, we know this is true. He said, if I were on the mound, the guy would not have been playing on the other side of second base.
Well, right? I wouldn't have thrown the ball.
right.
You know, he did not have great control as a young pitcher. He got more control. He dialed things down a little bit to get control, right, of the big heater he had as a young guy, to throw strikes, which is what Earl Weaver wanted. What he learned is how you win ball games, not by striking out every batter. You got great defenders behind you. Throw the ball over the plate, make them put in play, right? And Palmer doesn't abide all the walks. When you watch the 1970 World Series clips on YouTube, or when they reshow the game on Masson, look at that lineup that he's pitching against in the 1970s. And Palmer's going right at Johnny Bench. He's going right at Perez. He's going right at all those guys.
Lee May, right down the line.
Lee May's going right at them all.
Holen.
And that's what he can't abide, watching the guys who are trying to dance around the corner, trying to
nibble,
trying to make a perfect pitch. You've got to, at some point, you've got to step up and go after people, let the chips fall where they may. And he was never afraid to do that as an athlete, to step up there and go after people. And I think that's ultimately that. And you know, he doesn't blame the pitchers for not going nine innings anymore, because they're just not allowed to. But what he knows is McNally's, the Cuellars, the Palmers, they got exponentially better in innings 1 through 6 because they were allowed to pitch 7, 8, and 9 and figure out how to do it when you don't have your best fastball, when you don't have one pitch working, or maybe you only have one pitch working. How you get guys out when you don't have your best stuff, like in the 7th, 8th, and 9th, in the third time through the order. Ultimately, when you figure that out, you become tougher in the first 6 as well. And that's lost today. He doesn't like that, you know, obviously.
They wouldn't let Palmer pitch this way in the modern era. He's too wide open,
right?
Too much mechanical. Like, they would never let him do all of that, you know? Yeah. They would be saying, condense that, bring that in. He'd say, that's where the power comes from. That's where it's off my shoulder, and I'm not going to blow my arm out.
Yeah.
Like, so either way, listen, this thing started in 1954. We were going to talk about Andy Harris. Oh. I'm glad we skipped that because this is better than that. Moeller and I are still pissed at each other about the Orioles because I talk about the business and he talks about the dream team that he believes in. You got 150 more of it, and we'll have a dozen crab cakes between now and then. Ron Cassie, we dig you. Hold the Baltimore Magazine up. Give the pimp and Baltimore show me your old tabs, Don, for those who just came in.
Yeah, you got to, in order to be able to go to the stories when you talk to people, you got to have little tabs on them, and it takes me right to the story. If you're not reading Ron Cassie, if you're not reading Baltimore Magazine, you're missing out. It is great stuff.
That reminds me of his grade book back in Dundalk High with the little tabs, you know.
Tabs, baby.
Is that going to come with a deficiency slip that you guys called a midterm report to piss my parents off? I'm just asking.
Once a teacher, always a teacher. Absolutely. There we go. Thank you, Ron.
Ron, it was a great conversation. I should have you on Talk Baseball more often. Whenever there's relevant baseball to be talked here, I'm happy to talk about it. How about that?
Yeah, we love it. Yeah.
Let's keep the team here. Ron Cassie's here, Baltimore Magazine. Don Moeller, former Baltimore County executive, and my friend and foe when it comes to, I'll go to a game with you and your kids, grandkids named Brooks and all of that. All right.
Well, as long as you don't bitch about the ownership, and we're good to go. Don, just go have fun.
I'll stop bitching about the ownership when the ownership isn't worthy of me bitching about them. How about that? When they put the games on in spring training.
Let's just go watch.
That was only last week. That's right. I'm over that now. We're in the new news cycle. I am Nestor. He is Don Moeller, former Baltimore County executive. On behalf of all of our sponsors and all we do here, get yourself a crab cake, have a beer, and enjoy yourself some Orioles baseball. We are Baltimore positive, even when they lose.